Okay, so this is our Simon Don reading group, continuing with Individuation Volume 2 on the text History of the Notion of the Individual. So last time we read, the beginning of the 19th century section, where Simon Don talks about this sort of distinction between the order of succession, the order of simultaneity, now in the realm of the social order, as opposed to earlier, it was a distinction in the realm of the individual between like Plato and Aristotle, for example. So he takes it that Kant is an instance of the order of success of simultaneity being primary, and then Hegel is an instance of the order of succession being primary in understanding the social order. And he also had some interesting reflections on the relationship between some scientific developments of the 19th century and the notion of the individual, in particular, the introduction of the notion of a field of force, so an electric field or a magnetic field. So these fields have the property that an individual in a field is both acted on by the field and also participates in forming that field. So if you have a magnet in a magnetic field, the magnet contributes to the formation of that magnetic field, but is also affected by the magnetic field outside. So there's a sort of reciprocity between the individual and the surrounding of the individual. And so this sort of insertion of the individual into a sort of environment that is greater than it is sort of taken as a model for the insertion of a human individual into a social reality. So we, as individuals, we are part of a social order that shapes our actions and our thoughts and so on. But at the same time, we as individuals sort of act on that social order and contribute towards generating that social order. So this is a sort of a schema of thought that Simon Don argues is drawn from physics, from the notion of a field. And then there's also the other sort of key idea in physics that appears in the 19th century is the science of thermodynamics, and in particular, the fact that in the second law of thermodynamics, there's a direction of time, whereas in Newtonian physics, time is completely reversible. So if you take some evolution of a system in Newtonian mechanics, like the solar system or some projectile movement or whatever, if you take that movement and the evolution of that system, and then you just put a minus sign in front of the time variable and you run the whole thing backwards, that backwards evolution is still a possible evolution of a system in Newtonian physics. So the direction of time makes no difference in terms of whether something is possible or not. Whereas in thermodynamics, of course, we have this increase of entropy as time flows, or entropy increases with the direction of time. So a thermodynamic process is not reversible in the way that the Newtonian mechanical process is. So some sort of classic examples are, if you take a hot piece of metal and stick it into a bath of cold water, the metal will cool down and the water will heat up until they reach a thermodynamic equilibrium. But if you take a possible evolution of this thermodynamic system, but the reverse evolution where you have a bar of metal in a bath of water that are at the same temperature is not going to evolve into a hot bar of metal and a cooled bath of water outside of, unless there's an external source of energy. So the reverse evolution is not a possible thermodynamic evolution. So this sort of notion of a direction of time is sort of translated into the realm of social evolution. So the 19th century is characterized by many writers who have this notion of progress of history. So there's a direction of history. It's not just a sequence of events that happen. There's an actual sort of direction in which history is going. And so Simon Don compares he argues that these notions of a direction of history are sort of analogous to the notion of a direction of time in thermodynamics. And then, let's see, what else did we see? We looked at Joseph de Maistre a little bit, who is a kind of reactionary writer. So he's an anti-French Revolution writer in the early 19th century. And he, I mean, I don't know him well, I only know him sort of secondhand, but he has this idea of the individual as being inserted into a variety of different sort of fields of force. So there's the human individual is part of the domain of nature, and so is subject to natural laws. But there's also, for de Maistre, this idea that the human individual is incorporated into a supernatural order as well. And this supernatural order serves as sort of the basis or the structure in which human institutions are formed. So the pre-revolutionary state in France, the monarchy, and the distinction between the nobility and the commons and so on, all these elements of this order are sort of inherited from this supernatural order. And so trying as a human individual to change the order of society and create a better order is a kind of hubris or arrogance of the individual who sort of is contravening the supernatural order in which we are inserted. So this is his sort of general picture of why the French Revolution was not good in general. Okay, so we will continue on this sort of counter-revolutionary tradition today. So we can start reading on Bonnard, if someone else would like to read from that section.
Yes, I can read. Should I do Bonnard and Lamennais, or should we just do
Bonnard? Yeah, let's do both together. Yeah.
Okay. Bonnard. Bonnard's supernaturalism searches between the individual and supernatural reality for several mediations, which have a mysterious character superior to any artificial construction of the individual or of society. In the order of knowledge between ideas and the human individual is found language, which, far from being an arbitrary convention, is of divine institution. Language is the word. It has the power to evoke thought in the individual. The word is not the sign, but the expression of the idea. Quote, man thinks his speech before speaking his thought. Another quote, speech brings light into the darkness, and so to speak calls upon each idea, which responds, like the stars and Job, here I am. A second mediation is one that God-man realizes, the model of political power, the mediator between God and men. The fixity of power in a family ensures for this mediation a character of permanence and very great stability. The family is, in fact, the fixed and unalterable, quote-unquote, natural society, which is the model of civil society. The individual is therefore connected to ideas through the mediation of language in the order of knowledge, and to God through the mediation of legitimate hereditary power in the order of action. Lamennais. Lamennais seeks to expand this participation of the individual to the supernatural by fleeing, on the contrary, from the mediations that Bonnard sought, or rather by taking them into society as a whole and into history as a whole. Revelation did not take place at a precise moment in time. It has not been given to one church alone. It has been given to all humanity throughout all history and is now contained in the general beliefs of humanity. The indifference in matters of religion, which is a veritable intellectual and moral suicide, comes from an unlimited and excessive confidence in the individual of the individual in himself. In fact, the individual must have recourse to this mediation that humanity is. According to the 13th chapter of the Essay on Indifference in Matters of Religion, the isolated individual can attain nothing but misleading evidence, evidence which appears to Descartes when he is completely isolated from the world and from his peers. Quote, Descartes demonstrates nothing. To say, I think, is to say, I am thinking, is to posit as certain what one wants to prove. Madness is precisely an absolute isolation of the subject that involves an invincible individual yet erroneous conviction. Certainty can be found only in common reason. Quote, I call authority this common reason, unquote. The axioms themselves are recognized as true because they strike the reason of all men equally. Unlike for Bouffier, it is no longer individual faith that founds common consent and common sense. For Lamennais, common sense is a criterion by itself and does not need support. Quote, the Catholic faith and human reason rest upon the same foundation and are submitted to the same rule, such that lest one fall into the most absurd inconsistencies, one must either be Catholic or renounce all reason, unquote. Indeed, Lamennais' formula is the same as that through which the Church regulates beliefs, quote, quod semper, quod ubique, quod ab omnibus traditum est, unquote, which is translated as what has been handed down everywhere, always, and by everyone. Lamennais considers that religion constitutes the substructure of society, quote-unquote social conscience, according to the expression he uses in a letter to Mazzini. Only the people, as Lamennais thinks after 1830, can be the instrument of its own liberation, thanks to the appearance, quote, of a powerful religious faith that will doubtless be born, but the seeds of which we will hardly perceive, unquote. The universe manifests everything that a finite being can have of the infinite, according to the Essai d'un système de philosophie catholique. In nature, there is a gradation of beings that respects a trinitary structure. All creatures are an image or a trace of the divine trinity. Each singular body supposes a force or power that posits it, a form that designs its contours and determines its properties. A life that perpetually connects force to form up to man, who is an active, intelligent, and loving being. I guess what is a little bit interesting about Lamennais is that he seems to see reason, common sense, and faith as all aligned, as opposed to, I guess, earlier reactionaries who were irrationalists in one way or another because they saw reason as always ending in atheism or as sort of like always ending up in opposition to common sense.
Yeah, I mean, I only know Lamennais from this passage here in Simondon, so I can't really comment how accurate Simondon's explanation is. But it looks like for Lamennais, there's this idea that the common beliefs of humanity are what reason will end up at if it's sort of used properly. And it's only this sort of arrogant or individualist reason that has the appearance of being opposed to faith and the common beliefs of humanity. So reason in its proper use will lead to the same results as faith and the common beliefs of humanity.
That's kind of Kant's position too. I just finished the analytic of the second critique, where he's the part where he says, like, even though it seemed kind of dodgy for a while there, like whether reason was going to end up critiquing faith, you know, we should have faith in reason because it has brought us back to where we started, essentially, which is just, belief in God, freedom, and the soul.
Yeah. I mean, Kant is an interesting case because like even in the preface to the first critique, he says about how we need to limit knowledge to make room for faith. So one of the sort of major motivations for his whole intellectual program, or the critical program at least, is to sort of prevent reason from undermining faith in precisely those three items that you mentioned: the freedom, existence of the soul, the immortality of the soul in particular. Freedom of the will and the existence of God, and so the dialectic of reason is sort of a demonstration of the incapacity of reasoning to demonstrate the falsity of those propositions, even if it's at the same time an incapacity to demonstrate the truth of those propositions through pure reason. Critical project has one of the sort of major motivations is at least to prevent reason from undermining those three sort of pillars of faith, and the sort of consequence of that, or the corollary, is that you can't use reason to support those three pillars of faith either. So faith is sort of separated from reason in that sense for Kant. But then the sort of next step, as you mentioned in the practical philosophy, is to give these sort of non-demonstrative arguments. So you can't sort of prove the immortality of the soul in the way that pre-Kantian philosophers thought you could, but you can show that it's rational to believe in the immortality of the soul, and likewise for the other principles. So there's a kind of sort of detour that ends up at more or less the same place as you started off. I think it's an interesting comparison here between Lamennais and Kant.
It kind of makes me think of that, what we were talking about earlier before we started recording, with the Deleuze on circular motion, like the transgression in the first critique that results in the reconciliation, and halfway through the second, in the same way that maybe Deleuze would say of Aeschylus's tragedies.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also because, like, in the first critique, the Kantian conception of time is this is what Deleuze will depict as this linear picture of time, the time as a straight line, as opposed to the circular conception of time that we find in classical authors, Aristotle in particular. So Kant has this sort of one side or one element where he puts forward this linear image of time, but then he sort of takes it back and then returns to the circular conception of time, in that he sort of takes reason back to where it started from and goes through this whole elaborate process of critique just to sort of reaffirm the beliefs that you started with before you undertook the whole critical project. So yeah, that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, good point. He's kind of both of the ways of thinking about time.
Yeah, and that's one element that's I think interesting in Kant is this sort of tension between the two aspects of this project. Like he's definitely part of the whole Enlightenment tradition that sees reason as a necessary component of human freedom. That by the application of reason to our lives, we free ourselves from dogmatism and sort of unthinking tradition and so on. So he's definitely part of this Enlightenment tradition. But then at the same time, he also has this kind of counter-Enlightenment aspect, in the sense that he wants to limit the capacity of reason to undermine the principles of faith. So we apply reason to phenomena, to the realm of appearances, and we have this sort of Enlightenment project in the realm of appearances, but we have to limit the pretension of reason to go beyond the realm of appearances and undermine faith at the same time. So there's like an Enlightenment project and a counter-Enlightenment project that are sort of intertwined with each other in Kant.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a really good way to put that.
Okay, so let's go on to the next section. Ollie, would you like to read the next section on you can read. Let's just read the one section on destitute de tracé.
Okay, thank you. Sure. So destitute de tracé, is that right pronunciation?
De tracé.
Tracé. Okay.
Yeah.
The ideologue destitute de tracé, with the destitute de tracé, this will a faculty of knowledge that allows the individual to situate himself. His analysis of voluntary effort was taken again by Main de Behan. Perception of the belief in the exteriority of objects would be impossible without the feeling of resistance that our voluntary movement encounters when it is applied to matter. Quotes, a will makes our muscles contract, and we are worn by our feeling. Soon, many experiences teach us that the existence of this feeling is due to the resistance of what is called matter. And we certainly recognize that what resists our will is something other than our sentient virtue, our wills, and that, therefore, there is something else besides this sentient virtue that constitutes ourselves. If our will had never acted directly and immediately on anybody, we would never have doubted the existence of Buddhists. End of quotes. In the same way, language is not made of words. Static realities. As Destitut de Tressy says, language is essentially discourse, and the word is initially discourse, manifesting an activity, a will. The first sign is the interjection that already utters a judgment. It's only then that the attribute is separated from the subject, and that the interjection becomes verb. The primordial utility of language is therefore the indissoluble, soluble totality of the proposition composed of subjects and verb, not the word. The word expresses itself as judgment in the proposition. Lastly, the fourth section of the elements of ideology is a study of the will. The first seeks to discover how desires from the individual and their conformity are all opposition to the true conditions of our being. The genesis of love is studied in this section, and this study was utilized by Stendhal. The second part studies the way the will exerts its effects in action to provide for our needs. This study is important because the Tracy envisions the relation through which the different states of society and labor act on the individual. This association, the corporation, the family have different actions on the world. The world is therefore, in fact, an individual faculty, but it receives the influence of the social structure, and the individual world is modeled by social forms. Destitut de Tracy borrows significantly from the economist to say, who shows a preoccupation with the knowledge of de facto states and of the individual's integration into the social dynamic. It's through the infinitely varied reaction of the regime of the world that the individual is inserted into the field of social forces. Aha.
Right. Yeah, so a couple of interesting points here about Destitut de Tracy are so this notion of the will and voluntary effort as sort of our mode of access to the external world. This is a kind of tradition of this doctrine that we can already find it in Condillac to some extent. So he has his Treatise of Sensations, where he gives this thought experiment of, and we saw this a little bit in one of the earlier sections, this thought experiment of a statue in which the different senses appear one by one. And so Condillac argues that as soon as the statue has the sense of touch, so the capacity to experience the sensation of touch, then this statue will have knowledge of the external world, or will understand that other entities are distinct from it, whereas the other sensations don't produce this understanding in the statue. Here it's a slightly different argument in that it's not just the sensation of touch, but it's the sensation that accompanies voluntary effort. So it's the action of touching something or pushing against something, and the experience of the resistance of the object that you push against. This experience of resistance is what shows that there is something opposed to my will or distinct from my will. There's some entity outside me, because I experience resistance when I try to perform a certain action. And then Simondon mentions that Mende Biran takes up this conception later. So there's this sort of tradition that runs through like late 18th into early 19th century French philosophy, in particular, about this doctrine that um, the the feeling of effort is the basis of our understanding of the world as being distinct from ourselves. And then the other interesting point here is this analysis of language as consisting essentially in expression as opposed to representation. So if you conceive of language as consisting primarily of representation, then you would think of sort of the fundamental element of language as being the word that represents a certain object or a certain action or a certain property of an object or whatever. So the basic element of language would be the word that represents something. And then the sort of problem that you have to solve is how the different words combine with each other and the different representations that those words perform are combined with each other to form a more complex entity, like a sentence. But then this alternate account of language that we see with Destu de Tracy, and this probably goes back to Rousseau and Herder, people like that, this idea of language as expression. So in this conception, the sort of element of language is the interjection as opposed to the word. So in some sort of interjection, you have a speech act performed sort of indissolubly. You have one expression or one utterance that performs a speech act without being composed of parts. And then the problem for this sort of approach to language is to break up that unity of the speech act into components. So to take this interjection and to transform it into a complex expression that has parts, like a subject and an object, or a subject and a predicate. And so this is a sort of alternate approach. You start from this unity of the interjection and break it up, instead of starting from these components of that are words and combining them together to form complex expressions. So these are sort of two alternate approaches to the analysis of language and two different intellectual traditions that approach the analysis of language in two opposite ways.
So regarding the second point, the language thingy, as far as I understand, the emphasis on preposition, the preposition, because it's kind of like a connecting the subject and verb and so that. So I think this language is in a way like focus based on the French, not the other languages, and then particularly the preposition, like thinking of the considering the first position, I mean first point of just tracé, like how desires, like what kind of meaning of the will, like individual level implicates the point is like a relation, like how it is related to each other. So preposition or like individual world is influenced by the social factors, external factors. Those things are the point of this this person. So the preposition particularly like shows like the how subject and then verb, other parts of the languages like related to each other.
Yeah, so the sort of analysis of language here is definitely based on the languages that were familiar to European scholars of the early 19th century. So, you know, French, English, German, Latin, and then Greek probably was the sort of main points of comparison. But one sort of point of clarification that I think is important here is that the proposition, the proposition for Destu de Tracy is not a sort of combining of parts like a subject and a verb. It's a separating out of parts from this initial interjection. So the fundamental unit of language is an interjection, and then and this interjection performs a speech act autonomously or independently. You do something by interjecting. And then it's only later in the evolution of language that this interjection is sort of split up into components like a subject and a verb, or a subject and a predicate, or whatever other aspects of language we want to separate out. So Yeah, so the proposition is a complex unity, but it's a complex unity that results from the splitting of a simple unity, the initial interjection. And so it's not something that results from a composition of simple elements like words that would be combined with each other.
Maybe like my kind of like words, like a little bit like make a confusion. I mean, causes a confusion because here what I'm thinking is like, for example, like in French, the preposition de or par or a, so I mean, that kind of proposition shows like how the other parts of the languages are related to each other. So it shows like the direction of the influence, like. Something like that, like R equal to two in English. So like prepositions shows like how the each part, like verb and then like subject, how it is related to each other. So like the second position, like how the individual will is interrelated to the external variable, like the social variables, things like that. I mean, in that kind of same vein, same ideas. What do you think? Like prepositions, like a role, is like to connect the two parts, like something like that.
I think you're mixing up a preposition and a proposition. So a preposition is a part of speech, like the ones that you mentioned, à, vers, pour, de, or in English, you know, to, for, towards, etc. So these are prepositions. So they have the function that you mentioned. They sort of connect different parts of speech to each other. And then a proposition is a logical structure of that makes an assertion about something or something that can be asserted. Like you have a sentence, and a sentence you can say expresses a proposition. So the proposition is what is asserted by a sentence. So here, what Destu de Tracy is arguing is that a proposition, so this logical structure that can be asserted, is something that arises out of the splitting up of the original unity of an interjection. So he's not talking about preposition, he's talking about a proposition.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sort of a difficult point because the two words are so similar to each other. But yeah, it's good that you pointed that out. And then, yeah, so the connection between these two points, between the original sort of interjective or expressive function of language, and then the notion of the will and the sensation of effort as being primary in our knowledge of the external world. I think you're right that there is a connection between the two. Because as I mentioned, this sort of expressive function of language is a kind of action. So in expressing ourselves or in uttering an interjection, we perform an action of some kind. And so action and the will are, of course, intimately connected with each other. So, you know, we think of an action as something that you perform as a result of your volition, of your will. So you want to do something, and then you sort of exercise your will to bring about the performance of that action that you wanted to do. That's sort of like our, I guess, common sense picture of how action works. And so we can conceive of this sort of initial unity of the interjection, this sort of fundamentally expressive nature of language, as analogous to the sort of original unity of the will. And then the second stage where language sort of splits up into subject and predicate and so on, we can conceive that as analogous to the separation between myself and the external object that resists against my will. So in each case, we have this sort of primitive unity or initial unity that is split up into components, and so the complexity that we observe in our everyday lives and in our language is the result of a splitting and separation as opposed to a combination in both sides. Okay, So let's go on to the next section. I can read this section. Let me get a drink. Okay. Cabanis wants to connect the study of the individual to that of physiology, since the individual is a whole composed of body and soul. This point of view will also be that of Auguste Comte, who will make the analysis of the human faculties a chapter of physiology. For Cabanis, ages, sexes, temperaments, sicknesses, climate have a very large importance through the influence exerted on the intellect and mores. The individual finds his unity in organic sensations, which are independent of internal impressions and constitute instinct. It is in this way that Cabanis explains the suckling movement of the newborn and the spontaneous acts connected to the reproduction of the species. Instinct is the result of impressions received by the internal organs. The movements of instinct are comparable by their organization, their systematization, to those of the reflexive acts. They're not reducible to simple irritability. Their condition is a felt internal impression, just like the external impression that precedes acts, and not as an element of sensibility that would have first passed through consciousness. Consciousness is not the exclusive and distinctive characteristic of sensibility. Sensibility determines a number of important and regular functions without the self having received any warning. Organic changes in circulation or digestion have an unperceived influence on consciousness. After amputating the nerve innervating a muscle, the excitation of this muscle exerted locally produces the same movement as before. By following this path, Cabanis does not refuse to accept Van Helmont's hypothesis, according to which there are several centers of sensibility which each have a kind of partial self. The affirmation of the strict connection between the soul and the body is expressed by an invitation to consider the individual as composed of a plurality, and not an absolute plurality, but not an absolute plurality. This plurality consists of partial centers that each realize a certain unification within a particular domain. Individuality occurs in several stages and involves a synergy of functions of unification. This idea is quite rich and quite fruitful. It breaks with a substantialist representation of the individual being. It leads to studies that go all the way to those which are properly biological, but extremely important for reflection, of Sherrington with the law of integration. This distinction of centers of partial unification in the individual makes it possible to avoid the dualism and bisubstantialism of the soul and the body. No doubt, in a certain sense, the continuity of the activity of the internal organs as opposed to the discontinuity of external impressions. But while in Maine de Biran and Bichat, this duality is an irreducible given, Cabanis, on the contrary, considers that thought is a cerebral function, just as digestion is a function of the stomach. Quote, "If thought differs essentially from animal heat, just as animal heat differs essentially from chyle and semen, it will be necessary to resort to unknown and particular forces to bring into play the thinking organs to explain their influence on the other parts of the animal system. There is a unity of, unquote. There is a unity of nature. Various bodies, inorganic and living, consist of the same matter. Their various manifestations are due to the different way in which their elements are combined. There is no difference between the influence of the moral on the physical and that of the organs on one another. It is merely a particular case, as Mémoire 11 asserts, whose title is The Influence of the Moral on the Physical. Nature has within itself the necessary and sufficient conditions of its progress. The physical contains the principles without which our inclinations and our intelligence would have no direction. The moral could be isolated only by an artificial abstraction. Quote, sensations can be conceived only connected to one another and dependent on organic functions, unquote. Thus, at the same time as the individual loses his substantiality, he gains through his activity an extremely strong constitutive role. With his will and his instincts, the individual is the principal and starting point. In this sense, the individual is not, as with the ideologues, a simple moment of becoming. He expands his power to act and discovers his capacity in another way than that of messianism and a synthetic vision of the world, with a participation in supernatural forces. The individual is the being who can take an initiative, who can construct his life, who affirms himself unconditionally. He does not participate in a reality, he is an agent. Yeah, so this is an interesting sort of moment of intellectual history, because we have here, so in a certain sense, this is a continuation of the materialism of the 18th century. So this idea of thought as a cerebral function, in the same way as digestion is a function of the stomach, is a sort of straightforward materialist proposition. But at the same time, it's a kind of, holistic materialism, as opposed to a sort of mechanical materialism, in the sense that there's an idea of the organism as being unified and integrated, and acting as a whole unit, as opposed to sort of breaking down the individual into component parts and then having those parts interact with each other mechanically. So it's a materialism that sort of recognizes the specificity of organic life, of the structure of an organism as something that acts as a whole and not in terms of these parts that interact just mechanically. And so this means that there's a sort of downward causation is the term that's used in contemporary philosophy of mind. So the moral side or the intellectual side of the human being is capable of acting on the physical side. And so intellectual operations or properties of a living being work downwards onto the physical properties of that being. But this whole system, this whole living being is a material entity. And so there's nothing sort of supernatural about this downward causation. It's just this sort of complicated interaction of the parts of the entity with each other.
This kind of made me think of at least the Freud of beyond the pleasure principle and the idea that the ego basically carries around with it all these incompletely formed would-be egos that are somehow associated with inadequate kind of trauma responses, which, you know, act in a hidden way in conscious life through something like repetition compulsion. This kind of seems like a physical, this idea of multiple centers of cognition, kind of a physical, or I guess Freud would be like kind of a psychic version of Cabanis. I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting comparison, because I was going to mention this notion of sort of multiple centers of cognition and cognitive life as being something that goes beyond consciousness is something that is sort of reappears in contemporary cognitive science and neuroscience. I've been reading Stanislas Dehaene's book on consciousness. And so in that book, he argues and on the basis of a lot of different experiments that have been done over the past 30 years or so now, I guess, since the 90s, that show that, for example, you can display an image for a few milliseconds or a fraction of a second, a tenth of a second or so, and then show another image shortly after, and the subject observing doesn't consciously recognize the first image, so they respond only to the second image that is presented for a longer time. But then you can still show that the subject's performance on recognition tasks related to that first image is better than chance. So the first image that the subject doesn't consciously see is still processed in some way in the brain. And the subject, even though they don't have any conscious awareness of what the image was, they still are capable of sort of recognizing, they'll be quicker to respond with a word that matches the image as opposed to a word that doesn't match the image, for example. And so there's likewise in sort of contemporary neuroscience and cognitive science, there's this recognition of all sorts of sort of centers of cognition within our brain that are not necessarily accompanied by conscious awareness. And so there's the sort of problem that you have to solve in this conception is, you know, what is it that actually sort of unites these different centers of cognition to produce our experience of being a conscious entity, of, you know, having a continuous and unified experience during the time that we're awake and aware and so on. That's sort of like one of the key problems in the neuroscience of consciousness is how do these different, in our brain, there's like a million different centers of processing going on at any given moment that are, assembling visual information, assembling auditory information, monitoring the state of your body. All these things are going on at the same time. And only a very small portion of that ends up being sort of joined together to form an experience that we are consciously aware of. And so it's a similar type of schema, I guess, as what we find in Cabanis, where you have all these different centers of experience or centers of awareness throughout the body that have to be integrated into a sort of unified intellectual life or a unified life of the mind. And so that's a sort of a contemporary version of the same type of problem that Cabanis was dealing with in the early 19th century.
That's really interesting in light of like Klosowski's reading of Nietzsche, for instance, where, you know, he thinks that Nietzsche had this kind of insight into these, you know, not immediately conscious competing drives because of his, whatever is the source of his, all of his physical ailments was. But he seems to describe an experience of something like there being these, you know, multiple kind of competing and mostly unconscious centers of cognition that can kind of take turns taking over the driver's seat of the ego, basically.
Yeah, and Nietzsche is an interesting case because he, I think... Yeah, so you're right. He depicts the sort of elements of the unconscious life of the mind, or the sort of the realm of mind that surpasses the conscious realm, as being drives. So they're sort of volitional elements as opposed to cognitive elements. And so for Nietzsche, this volitional element has priority over the cognitive element. So we even when we do sort of an intellectual enterprise that has the goal to, you know, discover the truth about something, or that's how we sort of conceive of what we're doing when we do science or history or whatever other sort of intellectual enterprise, even this type of enterprise is governed by the interaction of various elements of the will. Or these various drives that sort of compete with each other. And so there's a will to truth, which is, you know, a product of a certain type of interaction of drives, in the same way that, you know, the will to procreate or whatever other sort of actions might result from the interaction of elements of the will. So, there's an interesting prioritization of the volitional elements in the mind over the cognitive elements in Nietzsche.
Thanks. Yeah, that's an interesting contrast. I didn't think about it that way.
And that's like within contemporary neuroscience, there's been to some extent a movement towards what's called affective neuroscience, which, you know, because a lot of there's been a sort of predominance of looking at the cognitive aspects of the brain and the mind throughout, you know, I mean, at least the 20th century and going back further probably as well. So to see that, you know, you have these analogies between the brain and a computer, for example, are sort of standard analogies. And the idea is that the brain is primarily an information processing device. For example, it takes in information about the outside world and does stuff to it. And then, you know, creates a model of the world and things like that. But then there's this whole other side of the mind that is sort of left out by that picture, which is the affective side. So obviously our experience of ourselves and of the world is not just one in which we sort of cognize things and, you know, determine that this entity has this property or whatever. We also have an affective experience of ourselves and of the world. So we, you know, at basically any time of our lives, you have some sort of determinate affective state. You're either in a good mood or a bad mood or a neutral mood. You have some sort of affective tone to your mental state at any given time. So there's been more attention to that, like, I guess, since probably the 90s sort of trying to rebalance, I guess, the depiction of what the brain and the mind are about, or what they sort of do most fundamentally, to not take it that information processing is sort of the general picture of the brain, but like take a sort of picture of the brain that involves an affective relationship to the rest of the body and to the world around the human individual.
I'd like to ask a question to clarify my understanding here. As far as I understand, he cannot be regard thinking processes like based on materialism. So that is the thinking or intelligence or like a will. Everything is like from the brain. Like so that's not entity. That's just like a faculty without brain or without something material thinking, thoughts, or the world. That's impossible, right? I mean, based on his opinion, that is it, right? First,
I think that's right. He's arguing that so he's opposed to sort of a dualistic approach to understanding the mind. So there's no such thing for Cabanis as a separate substance that would be the soul or the mind or something like that, that is distinct from the body. So our intellectual capacities are products of the brain in the same way that our capacity to digest food is a product of the stomach. There's an opposition to Cartesian dualism.
Yeah, so if that is so, then if you go to the last part, like the point here, then the human being is not the element of the whole universe, but the last line is like he is an agent. So which means like the individual itself is like a composition of every faculty, and then it functions as a kind of like the whole thing. Is it right? Understanding, like, well, I mean, like as you said, like a stomach functions as it is, and then brain functions as it is, all together composes, some represents some kind of the whole thing. Like, so the reason why, like, the author, I mean, Simon Dong presents here, like, the individual is an agent, not the participant in reality. The individual itself is like the whole universe or whole thing, something like that.
I think that last line where he says that the human individual does not participate in a reality, he is an agent. Here I think the point is to contrast Cabanis with the sort of reactionary writers that we looked at earlier, Joseph de Maistre, Bonnard, and Lamennais. So for these writers, the individual sort of gets its existence from participating in something beyond itself. So the social order, the supernatural order, and so on. Whereas now with Cabanis, we have instead this conception of the individual as being primarily, as consisting primarily of various activities. So, and in particular, the activity of the mind, or the intellectual activity, the activity of the brain. What the individual is essentially an entity that acts in a certain way. So we can sort of classify individuals in terms of the types of actions that they perform or the types of activities that they perform, as opposed to sort of understanding individuals in terms of what kind of reality they participate in, which is the approach of those early 19th century reactionary writers. So I think that's the sort of point of that last line of the section, is to make that contrast.
In a way, like, it's kind of like contradictory, like a little bit like the logically it has some kind of problem. So it's like thinking about the product or production of the brain. That's immaterial. And then immaterial, compared to other production of the other organs. What I want to say is, like, at the end of the day, like, the ego or the will, of course, like, that's kind of like a, some kind of production of the faculty of a brain, but that's different from the other production of other organs. Like, it has a much more power, and then it's like a material, and also it's kind of like could last as long than other production of other parts. Mentality, like, it can last us longer than the other production of our body, I mean, all the organs.
Yeah, so there's a few things in that comment. The first part was the immateriality of the production of the brain. So the mind, if we think of the mind as being the product of the brain, or thinking as the product of the brain, this is something immaterial, as opposed to the way that the stomach produces the substance of the rest of our body through digestion. This is a material product. I think the way that, I don't know Kevin Nis very well, I only know him secondhand, but I think the way he would respond to that is that we can see through the influence of the moral or the intellectual aspect of the human being on the body, that the activity of the brain is not immaterial. So because our moral or intellectual state has this capacity to change our physical state, that shows that the intellectual state or the intellectual activity is not something immaterial. It's actually something material. So the product of the brain, even though it's a very different kind of product than the product of the stomach, it's just as material. It has, it's affected by the body, and then it affects the body in return. I think that's probably how he would respond to that. So we have to sort of rethink our understanding of what it means for something to be material, re-understand our image of what thought is, and to think of thought as something material because it has effects on the body. It has a material activity.
Yeah, you spot on. Right. At the end of the day, what's called, like, the production of the brain affects the body, other parts. I understand. I can understand. Thank you.
Yeah, and then the other point was about the duration of the products of the products of the stomach have a sort of limited duration. So we eat something and then digest it, and then the next day we have to eat something again. Every day you have to keep replenishing the products of the stomach, whereas the products of the mind, you can sort of form an idea and then come back to it years later. They have this sort of capacity to persist through time that the products of the stomach don't have. I think that's right. So it's certainly true that we can sort of bring back an idea that we had years before and rethink something that we thought about years earlier. That's a sort of complicated question, because there's a difference between something existing over a period of time and then being reactivated after a period of time, I think. So an idea that I have today, I might sort of forget about it for 5 years and then think of it again 5 years later. Between now and then when I think about it again, that idea is sort of has a potential existence. So it's something that I could think of if I wanted to, or if I had occasion to think of it again, but it's not something that I am actively thinking about. So the idea, the persistence of the idea, is a kind of potentiality to reactivate that idea. So my brain produces an idea today, and then it retains the capacity to reproduce that idea later on. And so that's one that's one way that an idea or a product of the brain can persist through time. But another way, which is maybe more interesting or more complicated, is that I can sort of express my idea. I can take whatever idea or whatever product of the brain that I have and write it down in my notebook. And then I can, you know, go back to that notebook and find that idea again, or I can share that notebook with someone else and transmit my idea to another person. In this idea or this product of the brain can be transformed into something external to my brain, scribbling on a piece of paper that persists through time as well. And then that's a different way for an idea to persist over time. So yeah, it's there's sort of alternate ways to for an idea to persist through time and be capable of being reactivated at a later date in a way that there isn't really an analogous persistence through time of the functions of the stomach. You can't sort of externalize the functions of the stomach in the way that you can externalize the functions of the brain in writing something down. I think those are sort of disanalogies. So there are differences between the function of the stomach and functions of the brain, but I don't think they make a sort of difference in kind. So they're still, the functions of the brain are still material functions, but they just have this capacity to be reactivated or reproduced in a way that the functions of the stomach don't.
According to the information on the internet, like the Schopenhauer, like complimented his work. So I think about the work of Schopenhauer, like the kind of like, I think that's kind of like the thinking. I would like to call it 20th century thinking. So definitely, like as you explained, like the emotions from brain like dominate sometimes like a body, and then it causes some kind of like a different kind of activate some kind of like issues from physical body. And the second thing that comes to my mind is a Bergson, like a duration of memory. Maybe we can think more about that with the idea of the duration of Bergson. And the third thing comes to my mind is like there's a futurist movie. I can't remember the title, but the scientist is like had like the death of his wife, beloved wife, and then tried to take out the wife's mentality, like the intelligence at the brain. I know. The mental part from the actual physical body, and then try to keep it a computer as a data, and then the living organism, the wife is like the intelligence is working in the computer. That was the main point of the futurist movie. So these three things that came to my mind, and maybe it has to do with each other.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there in those different comments, and I know Angus has to leave pretty soon, so I don't want to sort of get into too much of that. But the relationship between or how we can understand mental life as material, I think is one of the sort of key problems for philosophy today. And we want to be able to think mental life as material without sort of reducing the complexity of mental life. So it would be easy to just say that certain elements of experience are sort of map onto different elements of the brain and different actions of different parts of the brain and so on, and then sort of reduce our mental life to just these simple components that we've been able to map onto activities of the brain. But I think what's a more interesting and more difficult project is to sort of take all the complexity of our mental life, our emotional life, and everything that we've seen in the Simondon book, what he calls spirituality and all these complicated and subtle aspects of our life, and try to understand that in material terms without sort of eliminating that complexity. So that's a very difficult project that I think is also very important.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, okay. So let's stop here for today. And then we only have, I think, three more sections. There's a section on Stendhal that's about, there's a section on Stendhal, and then a one paragraph section on Bichat. And then we have a longer section on Fichte, and a couple pages on Schelling. And then the last little bit is on Hölderlin. So we probably have like 2 weeks left of History of the Notion of the Individual. And then we have a couple weeks of other texts that are included in this book. So we can start thinking about ideas for what we want to read later. I've suggested a Merleau-Ponty book. But if other people have other suggestions, you can put them in the forum. And yeah, we can discuss those in the next few weeks.
Yeah, cool.
That sounds great.
Okay. Thanks everyone for coming out, and hope to see you next week.